Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Well, first of all, like, just tying it to your father's example, I have a feeling he wasn't easily discouraged. He came into a craft he knew nothing about, and he perfected it. And I'm kind of seeing that with you, is that just because you didn't have, you know, the formal background didn't stop you. In fact, in some ways, it probably made you better because you tried harder and you had to be more creative. And both on the planting side and the production side, wine production, it's so intimidating.
It is. And it's gotten, you know, from my early days of, the 1985, our first vintage, and where I was the winemaker those first few years, and not knowing what I was doing and asking questions as I was going. You go from there, and Napa has had this, the curve has ramped up. It's a very steep curve to really everyone kind of perfecting their craft, and you don't get away in this valley with any kind of sloppy workmanship, you know, either in the vineyard or in the winemaking side. And so it's buying the best barrels, having great equipment. It's all these things together now that you've got to have. And it's very expensive. But it also, I don't have a background in chemistry or biology. Mm-hmm. So there's a point, and I think, you know, we'll call it dumb luck, where I got out of the winemaking side and brought in a winemaker. Because it really does, I always tell people that are getting into this business, anyone can make wine. You can wait, you can go from this and go make wine tomorrow. And it can turn out good.
Yeah.
But it's when you get into a problem, how that problem's going to be undone. And what I've learned is, and I've learned through a lot of trial and error, is the fixes for these problems can be horrific. And you're left with a wine that may be fixed. I mean, fixed in terms that it's biologically, it's chemically, it's stable.
Yeah.
But it's been so horribly stripped in the process of making it drinkable that why do it? And so in the beginning, it really is. It's just watching every step, watching everything that you do, making all your moves really carefully. So that you don't have these mistakes at the end, that you're not trying to correct something. And that's been something that has, for me, I've made some vintages that I'm not proud of, for sure. But I also am pretty good about burying my stuff. If I make a real boo-boo, I get rid of it. And it's been a long time. And now with Niall Zachary, who's our winemaker, he's an absolute... He's the most anal character I've ever seen on winemaking. And you ask him a question, and you're hoping to get like a two, maybe three-word answer. You're going to get paragraphs of, you know, how these chains of molecules are locked together and what breaks some of them. And it's crazy talk. But I'm glad to have them.
I was going to ask you at some point why you chose Niles. Now you just answered my question. Clearly there's that synergy when he's detail oriented, and that's where the devil is. It's always in the details. And the fact that he's so incredibly in tune with every single, to the molecular level is what you described.
Absolutely.
Aspect that appeals to you.
I have to tell you, can I tell you the story how
of
I
met? Yes.
I was making a change in winemakers. Bob Engelhoff was our first winemaker.
That's right. I remember that.
But he was more on the consulting side.
Okay.
And he did a great job for a number of years. And I take it to be as much my fault as anything that, you know, probably I took my eye off the ball, because it was just great score after great score after great score. And you, as much as you tell yourself, don't get complacent, you do. So long story short, I needed to change what I was doing, and I needed to change winemakers. And I wanted someone now this time that would be full-time, that would live here, so to speak. So Heidi Barrett, had been my consultant in some years earlier, and she's been like a big sister, like a sister I never had.
Aww.
And old friend. And so I called Heidi and telling her, I said, could we meet for lunch? And so we met up in Calistoga at a restaurant. Oh, I think it was Wapo Grill. Remember Wapo Grill?
Met at Wapo Grill. I do remember that.
And I started talking to her. I said, hey, so I'm looking for a winemaker. She says, I thought you probably were. She says, I know the guy. I said, that fast? I said, she's yes. I said, who is it? She says, it's Niall Zacherle. I said, how is he keeping track of everything? She goes, crazy, crazy accurate, and makes more notes on things. It's just to a level you won't believe. That sounds like my guy. So we'd kind of finished the conversation pretty much before we even had our entree served. We had wrapped up this part of the business. And so I turned on her and I said, Heidi, what's new with you? And she says, well, the craziest thing. She goes, Bo and I have been going down to Hollywood. You know, and we're a bunch of country people. And I said, Hollywood? What are you doing down in Hollywood? She goes, well, they're gonna make this movie about Bo and you know and what happened in the Paris
bottle shock. Yeah.
And so I said, they are. I said, yeah. What movie is this gonna call? She goes, they're gonna call it Bottle Shock.
Sorry to give it away.
No, early. Right. So that was where I first heard about the movie, and so I heard about it maybe, I don't know, 6 months before it ever came out. But
very cool.
Taking people from the valley, you know, bringing them down to Hollywood and doing a movie was way outside of something I was used to hearing about.
It's so funny to hear you say this because on the outside looking in, which really all of us are, and for pretending a little to be the insider, unless you're in the valley and you're in production, it's something else. We do see you as major rock stars. And when you say, hey, we're farmers, and this was all new, and it kind of happened exponentially, and now it's a different perception value, but at heart, you identify as a farmer, don't you?
Oh, yeah. No, if I'm at a dinner or I'm meeting someone, they'll say, what do you do? I say, I'm a farmer. Sometimes I can even be meeting people for a dinner that I'll be speaking at, and they don't know that it's a winemaker David Arthur dinner. Yeah. And so they'll be saying, what do you do for a living? And I say, I'm a farmer. And they will say, oh, what do you farm? And then I realize they don't know why I'm there. And I say, well, actually, I farm grapes. And then sometimes, not always, sometimes they still won't make the connection. And then usually it'll unfold and say, oh, wine grapes? I said, yeah. I said, oh, are you the David Arthur? I said, yeah. Yeah.
You're that David Arthur.
But you're right. But even my wife, I'm on my third marriage. And Jen, my wife, I met her in Mexico. I was down there kind of a crazy story. I was down there. I had come down with a little bit of melanoma. It actually worked out really well. I met my wife. I didn't have any hair on my head. And I was down in Mexico to buy a home. Mm-hmm. No one was telling me, you have 4 weeks, you have 4 years, you have 40 years. You know, no one was telling you that. And I just kind of, you know, I just jumped ahead of it. And I thought, well, I've always wanted to have a home in Mexico. And, I'm also good at watching the Corona beer commercials, you know, and the shots from behind the bottles of Corona and the beach. That really stuck with me. So I went to Mexico to buy a home there. And in the buying of the home, I met my wife, Jen, there. Mm. And she asked me, she said, you know, finally comes up to, you know, now what do you do? And I said, I'm a farmer. And for the next 6 months, she thought maybe I farmed corn. Mm. You know, she was kind of picturing the Mr. Green jeans, right? And the farmer overalls. And she didn't know that I farmed grapes. She didn't make I gave her a bottle of wine even one time. Mm-hmm. Where she was working in Mexico, I dropped off a bottle of wine. She didn't know that that was me. That was my wine. Just that I was giving her a bottle of wine. Didn't know 6 months later until I said, you know, have you ever been in Napa Valley? She said, no. And we drove up the hill. I said, these are vineyards. I said, yeah, these are the grapes that I grow. Mm-hmm. She had no idea. So
that's priceless. So was she in real estate then?
No, she was... Actually, she was mortgage
okay, brokerage. Banking.
Yeah.
Wow. So you still have a home in Mexico?
Yeah.
Only now it's the two of you that inhabit it.
And now I have no time to go there. Now I'm too busy. Yeah.
Is she involved in the business here at all? Or?
No, she's involved in real estate in Napa Valley. And,
really interesting.
She got into it. I'm surprised. I guess it's already been 8-9 years.
So and, cool.
Yeah, well, she...
It's probably good, the union to separate worlds.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But, you know, she's on the phone nonstop, and I never want to be on the phone.
What a cool story, though, that you went there because you finally gave yourself permission to buy a property where you just hang out and enjoy yourself.
You know, it was a time, too, where the story kind of goes on where when I was shopping for a home and the realtor was driving me around, this guy, Dan, he was driving me around. We're at the places in Todos Santos in Baja California. And he was driving around. We were looking at both lots and houses, and these drugs make you tired, tired. And so I was getting tired. So I said to him, I said, hey, after this place we're going to right now, I want to go have, it's Miller time. I want to go have a beer and just watch the sunset. And he said, okay, fine. And I was in kind of a negative place.
Of course.
I've never been this really negative, but I was in kind of a negative place.
Yeah.
And, Dan, instead of taking me into town after this last place, he pulls in to see another house. And I say to him, Dan, you don't know me that well, but I will kill you and take your car.
And he looked at me. You see that with a smile like that, I love
it. He looked at me like, who do I have in the car with me? And I said, I'm sorry. I said, I'm not in a good space in my life right now.
Yeah.
Well, the house that he took me to was the house that Jen, my wife, was renting. It was also for sale. So he was showing the house, but he didn't call ahead to let her leave the house for us to see it. So we walked to the door, and I see this woman walk by the, you know, the glass before the door, and I see her, and I think, oh, pretty lady. You know, so we come in and he says, excuse me, sorry for barging in, but could we see the house? And of course she says, oh, sure, come on in. And it was a big house. And I didn't care for the construction on the house. I didn't think it was well built. And and the layout was bad. I didn't like it. But I liked the girl. So at the end of the kind of this tour, I went and I found her to say, thank you for letting us barge in to see your house. And she said, no problem. And she was so sweet. And she said, how long are you here? And I said, I'm here probably 4 more days. And she said, what are you going to do while you're here? And I said, what is there to do in this town? And she said, really, nothing. She says, tonight, though, there's a drumming corps coming through the town that will be teaching the children how to play the drums. And I said, that's it? And so I got back with my driver, and I said, hey, we're going to come back here tonight to this Hotel California to see these kids learn to play the drums. And my driver said, no, no, I've got another place for you to go. And I said, nope, we're coming back here. And, you know, of course we came back. And I met Jen again, and we then were together the next few days while she helped show me other properties. And I never thought she would have anything to do with me. I was actually surprised. That's sort of her short suit. She has to deal with that one. I got to really like her, but she saw kind of this dark side of me, but she saw that there was a light side underneath, and she said, you know, you seem like a pretty fun guy, like you could be pretty fun, but that you, she says, you need to now walk more in the sunshine.
Is that what attracted you to her?
Yeah. I felt like the sun definitely, I've said this to her 1,000 times, when I met her, that very next morning for coffee, after meeting her that afternoon, when we met for coffee the next morning, I felt honestly like this ray of sunshine actually was on this person walking towards me and just lit up by it. And she just has this personality that's full of light, and she got me to be in the sunshine. And also, this other thing that she teaches me is, don't go where you know evil exists. If you know you're going to walk into some deal and it's not a great situation for you, don't go. And that's kept me out of a lot of mischief and trouble.
What a great partner to have.
She is. She really is. She's great. And her and my daughter Laura are, it took some time to work through this, but they are now, they are thick as thieves. As a matter of fact, they actually conspire on things. You know, like, I don't like to go in for physicals or go into the doctor for anything, and those two conspire together to, you know, make sure there's nothing I have going on the calendar that day, and they drive
me. They take care of you. That's wonderful. I'm so glad that you have that kind of support, because no man is an island. You absolutely need that.
And that would be a terrible island.
No, but it's interesting that how life works out when you're in that dark space and you all of a sudden meet this person that redirects it.
Yeah. No, Jen is that person. No question.
Well, again, one of those heartwarming moments that we can all use, because, you know, we all veer off path. And it's great when it's best if the person appears in our path, but sometimes just things are shown to us when we're ready, even when we don't think that we are.
No.
So I keep wanting to go back,
go back
in the time machine, because I'm so curious.
I'm going to take us off course.
No, but I thought, you know, and I think a lot of us are guilty of that. We think we know the brand just because we've had the wines and admired them, and you have this idea in your head. But yet the real story is often different, and so much more, exponentially more. So this hard work, this had to have been dogged dedication, getting this brand off the ground.
Oh.
How many acres did you have? Or do you have, I should say?
It's only 20 planted, maybe 20.5.
Okay.
And the initial planting was 10.
And you planted Chardonnay.
Planted Chardonnay and had that going for about 5 years.
5 years.
And this is not only is it the wrong climate temperature-wise for Chardonnay.
Right.
It's too warm for Chardonnay.
Okay.
But it also, there'll be some breezes up here that Chardonnay is typically the first thing that leaves out. And so Chardonnay will put out these canes that are 4 and 5 feet long. And if you ever look at Chardonnay leaves, they're like sails. They're huge. They're giant leaves. They're supposed to be Cabernet leaves, right?
Yeah.
Chardonnay are these giant leaves.
Very vigorous, huh?
And any wind then that would go down the vineyard row, these leaves would catch it, would catch that wind, and snap off those canes.
Oh.
And so you'd be walking down the vineyard row and it was just broken off canes left and right.
Oh, interesting.
And of course, on those canes contain your next year's fruit.
Mm-hmm.
So you get kind of wiped out. So after fighting this for about 5 years, it was actually Tony Soder. That's another story. In 1970, I worked for Tony Soder at Chapelet. And that's where I cut my teeth in winemaking.
Makes sense.
It's next door.
I knew that there was the really important reason why you're so dang good.
And so I cut my teeth there, and it was you know, washing barrels and cleaning tanks. And then learn to press grapes, and then, you know, learning what goes into good winemaking. And so I worked for Tony in 78, and then in 1985, he worked for me. So we had this
full circle.
We had this change. And when he was here, he said, "Hey, it's all great to grow Chardonnay, David, but you do realize this is red grape country up on this hill."
So he knew.
He knew.
He was the guy.
It was fully him that got me going on planting Cabernet, and then Cabernet Franc, Merlot, Petit Verdot, Sangiovese. Sangiovese was really mine. That was my end because I didn't care for Malbec. You know that story, right?
I do, but I want the listeners to hear it.
So I make one called Meritaggio,
which is freaking delicious.
Which I would tell anyone to, don't pick a name that's so hard to pronounce, because I've been saying Meritaggio until my tongue bleeds, and I'd go another route if I was to begin. But my father also pushed me to make a Bordeaux blend. Tony pushed me to plant Cabernet. My father pushed me to make a Bordeaux blend.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have my little table in my kitchen up on the hill here. And I would do my tasting at say 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. It was when it was quiet in my house. And I'd have maybe 50, 60, 70 glasses of wine on the table. And I was working on a blend for this Bordeaux blend because I wanted it to be all estate. I wanted to handle on what percentage of each grape I needed to then go and plant.
Yeah.
So that 7, 8 years down the road, I could then make an estate grown wine from my own vineyards. So I set out to do that one night, or a lot of nights, and I this one night now, I finally kind of had my notes and I had my percentages of what I was going to plant.
Yeah.
And a gentleman that was selling my Chardonnay in New York had sent me some Sangiovese. It was on this box on the floor of my kitchen, and I opened this box and I see this Sangiovese. And again, this is 30 some years ago. I didn't know what Sangiovese was.
Yeah.
I had no clue on Italian grapes. And so I see this, and now it's about 4 o'clock. It's about 4 in the morning our time, and I knew it was 7 New York time. So I give him a call and I said, Louis, I said, what is this Sangiovese? And he said, David, you don't know the wines of Chianti? And I said, what? Chianti? I said, isn't that's that bottle? You know, it's got a wicker basket around it. You know, you put a candle in it, melt the wax. He says, you know what? He says, call me later on. He says, try the wine, call me later, we'll talk about it. So I open the wine and I taste the Sangiovese very separately by its own. And I thought that the wine was either poorly made.
Yeah.
Or, you know, this term rustic gets thrown around. You know,
yeah.
What's rustic? I'm not sure. Maybe this was rustic. And I look now, it was really rustic. But I was thinking bad. And maybe even partially corked. I'm not sure. And you know, there was a lot going on there. But I still enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. So now it gets to be about 6 o'clock in the morning, and it's time to actually go to work. I always tell people, now think about that one. I've been drinking wine all night. Now I'm hopping on a tractor. So I'm getting ready to clean things up and take the glasses over to the sink to dump them down the drain. And I had this French blend that I would make this blend, Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, Merlot, Petit Verdot, but I decided to leave Malbec off. I was not a fan of Malbec. Okay. Now, again, this is 30-some years ago. They're made much better now, but back then, the Malbecs that I tried, which were really rare to find, were like really barky, just really, really rough. And I thought it was a detractor.
Yeah.
So I thought, I'll make this wine for French. I'll leave the fifth grape Malbec off. So now I've made those blends. He made that blend. Now I'm going to the sink to dump my glasses out, clean up the kitchen. And I thought, oh, before I do this, I wonder what some of this Sangiovese would be like in this otherwise French blend. So I poured some in, and I liked it. So now I sat back down, and I thought, how much can this tolerate? How much of this Sangiovese can I push into this and enjoy it before it really becomes something else? And so I think I was making these first blends with like 5, 10, 11% Sangiovese in them. And I just came to love it. And I decided that's what I was going to make and not make this perfect Bordeaux. And, you know, it wasn't, I at the time, I didn't give a damn. I should have. Didn't give a damn about what critics would say or how they would accept this or not accept this. I just wanted to make a wine that I loved. So now, you know, years go by and I've planted these grapes, including the Sangiovese, and now I'm harvesting them and now I'm making the wine. And my brother, who was my partner at the time, my brother Bob, said, hey, what are you going to call your first red wine? What are you going to call this? And, you know, it's this mix of all these with Sangiovese. He says, what are you going to call it? And I said, well, you know, the Meritage wines are coming out now, right? Of course, those were just now starting to surface. That name is starting to surface. And I said, it doesn't fit that because it's got Sangiovese. And he says, so what are you going to call it? I said, I'm going to call it Red Table Wine. Yeah. My brother says, you know what? He says, I'm going to fly out from Chicago tomorrow and kill you. He says, you can make wine, but you cannot name wine. I said, yeah, no. I said, Red Table Wine. I said, everyone will learn that Red Table Wine really is a great wine from David Arthur. My brother says, we won't live long enough for them to ever learn that. He says, when do you go to press on this label, this Red Table Wine?
Uh-huh.
I said, actually, tomorrow. It goes to print tomorrow. He said, as your brother, as your partner, you owe me 24 hours to come up with another name. And I was ticked. I thought, no, you know, I don't like to be stopped. I hate being stopped. And so here was all of a sudden this big stop sign. So I called the printing company and said, hey, hold off on this label. Just hold. I said, okay. So the next day, the phone rings, and, you know, our winery is small at the time. We just had a little phone, a little small little lab that I had. And I answer the phone and I say, "Hello, David Arthur Vineyards." And I hear my brother's voice on the other end just say, "Meritaggio," and he hung up on me. And of course, that became the name of the wine. And so I've had to live with that name for a long time. Similar story with the Elevation. When the Elevation wine was made, a phone call came from my brother, and he said, what are you going to call this wine? And I was thinking back to some years earlier and how the Meritaggio story went on me. Mm-hmm. And I thought I'd be so smart. And I said, I'm not sure what I'm going to call it. I said, I'm going to work on a name. I'm going to really give it some thought. And he said, good. He says, I'm glad to hear that. He says, do you still have the topographical map in our office, in your office, that has the elevations of all the vineyards we own? And I said, yeah, I do. I look at the topographical map, and I said, it's exactly 1,147 feet. I said, that's the elevations of the vineyards that makes that wine that I love, that we're making. My brother says, 1,147 feet? I said, yes. My brother says, that's the name of the new wine, you moron, and hangs up on me. So I haven't been so good at naming wines.
No, but your brother seems to have a magical touch.
He does.
And it's like a Jedi mind trick. He says it and you do it.
That's just making me more angry to hear that.
No, but, you know, when I first saw the bottleneck, it just made sense. You know, the name actually fits. Because the flavor profile was so elevated, somehow on a subconscious level, to me, it's like, yes, those are those Wuthering Heights. It makes sense that somewhere up in the magical hill, this kind of stuff happens, so you can make wines like that.
Well, thank you. And that was, you know, getting there was, you know, I always tell people the story that when you're in this business, and again, my road was a dirt road. It wasn't paved like this.
Yeah.
For 17 years that I lived here, it was a dirt road that you bumped away. It was a 45-minute drive to get where you are right now. That now is 3 or 4 minutes. That was 45 minutes.
Wow.
So when I had someone here, and I'd have about 2 guests here a month. But when I had those 2 guests here, I wanted to be sure that we were barrel tasting. I wanted to be sure that I pulled wine from a barrel that I knew was a home run.
Yeah.
And so you think all barrels, all your wine will be the same, and it's not. Mm-hmm. So I'd find those barrels, go to that barrel, before, you know, if it was the last thing they were going to taste before they drove their car down the hill, I wanted to put some wine in their glass so that when they would leave, hopefully they would drive down that driveway going, oh my God, the wine from David Arthur is smoking.
Yeah.
So finally, then after that, it took me about, because I'm slow, it took me about 4 more years to recognize that those grapes that made that wine from that vineyard needed to be something separate and special for everything else I did. And that's how that happened.
Well, you're clearly a very thoughtful human being. You don't just rush into things and just kind of throw them out there. Your winemaking, even early on, I know that Bob was involved, but in that iteration of the valley, they stood out for the cerebral aspects as well as hedonistic.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I can say that intelligently because I've tasted the wines for... now probably, what, close to 20 years?
We drank them together.
I know. But it's like there is so much personality to your wine.
Oh, thank
and
you.
I never really got a chance to ask you then, but I do now. You're mine. What was your philosophy like early on, like when you started making wine? What was in your head?
You know, I'd love to just say there's like just some really just very flowery kind of statement I go into. I will tell you, it was nothing more than, I knew that the soil up here would support great wine. I'd seen what Don Chapelet had done in these early years, and I knew we could do it.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.